Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Home Interrupted, a new podcast from our partners at Feet in Two Worlds. Climate change affects everyone, but it doesn't affect everyone equally. Immigrants often bear a unique burden due to climate change, but they're also leading the way with impactful solutions. Feet in Two Worlds, the news outlet and journalism training organization for immigrant voices, presents Home Interrupted. From flooded basement apartments in New York City to indigenous Maya farming practices in Nebraska, Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted brings you deeply reported original stories from across the United States. Episodes drop each week starting April 2nd. Find Feet in Two Worlds' Home Interrupted wherever you listen to podcasts. Hey everyone, it's Marvin. This episode of Books and Boba is brought to you by Audible Theater Presents Good Enemy, a world premiere play by Audible Theater emerging playwright Yilang Liu, directed by Obie Award winner Che Yu, about a father who learns that closing the door to his past means shutting his daughter out. Good Enemy deftly weaves together the stories of two generations and two countries, the US and China, both during times of sweeping social changes, exploring the power of human connections. This smart, thrilling, and hopeful show features a road trip across America, theatrical flashbacks to 1984 China, action, suspense, secrets, discussions of generational trauma, and the bonding power of TikTok. The show stars Obie Award winner Frances Ju, who was previously seen on Broadway in Pacific Overtures as well as Soft Power at the Public. Previews for the show have already begun at the Minetta Lane Theater in New York City, and it will run for a strictly limited 5-week engagement through November 27th. Tickets are available now at goodenemyplay.com. And for Books and Boba listeners lucky enough to be in New York at this time, we have a special treat for you. If you use the code BOBA25, that's B-O-B-A-25, all caps, you'll be able to unlock a special discount on your tickets. Specifically, if you purchase tickets through November 5th, you'll be able to unlock $25 tickets using the code. And if you purchase afterwards, you'll unlock a 25% discount. Again, the play is running through November 27th at the Minetta Lane Theater in New York City. You can buy tickets at goodenemyplay.com. And don't forget to use the special Books and Boba discount code BOBA25, all caps. And if you do manage to catch this play, please let us know what you think on our Goodreads forums. Thanks again to Audible Theater Presents Good Enemy for supporting Books and Boba. And now, on with the show.
You're listening to... Whoa! Potluck. Potluck.
Hey, you're listening to Books and Boba, a book club and podcast featuring books by Asian and Asian American authors. My name is Marvin Yue.
And I'm Rira Yu.
And we are here today to discuss our October 2022 book club pick, The Hole by Hae Young Pyung, a psychological thriller about a man who finds himself at the mercy of his mother-in-law. Rira, happy November.
Happy November. Yes, we are coming to you a little bit late, folks. We did have some scheduling issues and we did do a lot of author interviews. So apologies that we couldn't make it to the end of Spooktober for this discussion.
I mean, technically, we're still the week of the end of Spooktober. So we're still hitting our intended release a week, just a little bit.
Okay.
Late.
Yeah, just a little bit.
Just a little bit. But yeah, as always, when we discuss our book club picks, we're going to be discussing the entirety of the book, including plot spoilers and twists. So if you have not read the book yet, we recommend you to go read it first. It's a pretty quick read, only like about 200 pages. Or if you listen to audiobook, an easy like 2.5 hours if you listen at 2x speed.
That's because we're insane.
You know, I listen to podcasts at 1x, but I listen to my audiobooks at like 1.8 because...
Oh, that's funny. I listen to our podcast at like 1.5 speed, and usually other podcasts, it's double speed. So wow. I listen to everything at double speed.
You see, I mean, it's all on everyone's individual preferences. For me, I like listening to my podcast as intended, but when I listen to audiobooks, I don't like reading with my ears at a slower pace than I can read with my eyes. So
yeah,
that's kind of, yeah.
Well, I read this book through audiobook, and I have to say, I kind of wish that I read it through a physical copy, because I heard that...
There's some visual stuff on the video.
Yeah, there's some visual stuff that happens. And this book actually has a lot of subtle details, and I missed a couple, so I had to, like, look at author interviews to see, like, if there's anything that I missed. And,
I know. I also listened to this book on audiobook, and I read that there were some, like, visual cues that were on the page, and I was like, I mean, the Kindle version's only, like, $14. I can probably swing that, but I... I controlled myself and my spending this one time. But yeah, let's just get into it then. Rira, do you want to start us off with the book jacket description?
All right. Ogi has woken from a coma after causing a devastating car accident that took his wife's life and left him paralyzed and badly disfigured. His caretaker is his mother-in-law, a widow grieving the loss of her only child. Ogi is neglected and left alone in his bed. His world shrinks to the room he lies in, and his memories of his troubled relationship with his wife, a sensitive, intelligent woman who found all of her life goals thwarted except for one, cultivating the garden in front of their house. But soon Ogi notices his mother-in-law in the abandoned garden, uprooting what his wife had worked so hard to plant and obsessively digging larger and larger holes. When asked, she answers only that she is finishing what her daughter started. So this book came out in 2016 and was immediately a bestseller. Haeyoung Pyeon is a very well-known author in Korea. And this book was originally a short story for The New Yorker, and it was called Caring for Plants. I'm sure it wasn't originally published in The New Yorker because I think it got translated and then published. But,
Probably.
So it's really interesting because I read like maybe like the first half of the short story like back when it came out, I think. And I was like, oh, this vaguely sounds familiar. And it turns out that it was pretty much the same intro for this book.
Yeah. I mean, I came in pretty cold. All I knew was the basic boilerplate that we've been giving on our podcast and that it was our Spooktober pick. And I guess, you know, you kept warning me that it's not actually a spooky book, but I kept thinking it might get spooky anytime now because the story is very, it's super unsettling, right? The entire time, everyone's keeping secrets from each other, including the main character. And yeah, I found myself, even listening to the book, feeling like tense throughout the entire thing. Like it was a really good thriller in that aspect.
Yeah, for people who jumped in cold, I guess like from the opening, you'll think that it's a ghost story because the first thing that Ogi sees in the hospital is his dead wife hanging from the ceiling, staring into his face. And you're like, oh, is this like a ghost story about a vengeful wife haunting him? It's like, no, that's the only time when the ghost shows up.
I mean, figuratively, it might
be figuratively,
that, right?
Yes, but it's not a ghost story. It's a thriller and a very claustrophobic one. And it doesn't really feature any like classic horror stuff, but it is horror in a sense that it shows the monstrosity of humans.
Yeah, it's horror in terms of like Misery as a horror film, right? Like a film about...
Speaking of Misery, yeah, it gets compared to Stephen King's Misery quite a lot.
Yeah, it's like Misery, but like taken to an even further extreme, right? Because the main character isn't just injured, but like completely disabled.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of wish that I was able to read this book in its original language because there's a lot of wordplay. Even just from reading the English version, I was like, oh, I know what this is in Korean. Like Ogi, the main character's name, it actually means refusal to give up, like stubbornness. And like that was like a very purposeful name that the author like gave him because he is persistently trying to escape his mother-in-law's imprisonment. And also, like, the title, the hole, in Korean, it's just called hol, and that is, like, the, I guess, like, the Korean version of hole in pronunciation wise.
It's like a romanization or no, like reverse romanization?
Koreanization? Hangulization? I don't know. But so hole can mean like the Korean pronunciation of hole. It also is the prefix for solo, like being alone. It's also referencing widowhood. And of course, you know, holes in one's life, emptiness. That is like a major recurring theme in this book. So, and there's like more wordplay. Like there's a paragraph about the word 자기, which is an endearment that couples use. It also means oneself, and then means darling. And it also means like pottery. So there's a lot of wordplay. And I heard that that is Haeyong-pyeon's style of writing. So I was like, oh man, I wish my Korean was better.
Yeah. I mean, we just interviewed Anton Her, the translator of I Want to Die, But I Want to Eat Tteokbokki by Baek-se-hee earlier this week for an interview we'll be releasing next week. But we talked all about like how hard it is to translate things like that. And I know that specific term you mentioned, the jeggi, was something that this translator agonized over, like how to translate that term to English.
Yeah, yeah. And I was just like, because she pretty much like briefly explained the different definitions in the book. And I was like, oh, in the Korean version, you probably didn't have to like explain it. It's just there. And I was like, oh, it must have been so hard for her to contextualize that for Western audiences.
Yeah, but that being said, listening to the book, I didn't feel like I was listening to a translation of a foreign language book. Like, I think she did a really good job translating the dread and the tension and even the language of the book. And this book has a lot to do with language communication, what one says and what one doesn't say. I don't know about you, but I got a lot of like Kafka vibes from it, especially like Metamorphosis, right? Like this man wakes up one day in a body that he does not recognize, right? And everyone also starts seeing him differently. And I definitely got some of those vibes as well.
Yeah, yeah. The thing about Haeyong-pyeon is, this is kind of a spoiler, she writes a lot of toxic men in her books. So like when Ogi is talking, like, because this is kind of in his perspective, it's written in third person. There's a little bit of distance between the protagonist and the reader. However, it's written in his perspective. You know, he's kind of saying like, oh, I have like a successful career as a college professor in this very obscure field. Like, I was still loving to my wife, who was a failure at everything.
He says that a lot. Like, I want to count every time he mentions that his wife is a failure at everything. Because it got, like, I was, are you okay, dude?
Like, I mean, in the beginning, you just kind of give him the benefit of the doubt that, like, he is, like, a normal, ordinary person who was probably a good husband. But honestly, he is the fucking worst. And just from knowing that Haeyong-pyeon writes toxic Korean men in her books, this is her fourth novel. So I was just like, oh, yeah, he's probably not as good as he says he is. And also, he is the only named character in the book. And because this is written in his perspective, I'm like,
well,
okay, how self-centered are you?
And his mistress.
No, I mean, they're not real names, though.
Really?
It's, yeah. Yeah, he's the only character who is named. Like, the names that he gives his friends, it's like S, K. And I'm like, those are just initials. That's not even their names.
You know what? I think because I listened to this audiobook, I missed that part, and I just assumed his mistress's name was just J, like J-A-E. Which can be a Korean name.
It's definitely a common Korean nickname. But yeah, I was like, he's the only named character. He's so self-centered because all he talks about is how great he is. And once he, you know, recovers, how he's going to like get back his tenured position. And I'm like, your wife died. Like, why does it seem like you don't care about her at all?
He did suck real bad, especially when he's describing why his wife failed a lot of things. And it's because, well, she stood up against the patriarchy and was punished for it. Like, he acknowledged that she was being discriminated against, but he never took an active role in any of that. It was just something that she had to deal with because, you know, that's what she chose to do.
Yeah, I mean, his wife was put in a very isolated position because she, you know, is having trouble with her career. And, you know, it's pretty ironic that she is unnamed in the book because all she wants is to be, like, to be good at something and to be remembered for it. And you don't even get her name at the very end. So the isolation, that just reminded me of a lot of Korean women, especially like older Korean women, maybe like boomer generation, because so much of the patriarchy has just like suffocated them and they just have to, you know, endure whatever position that they're shoved into, which is usually like working, like being a housewife, only supporting their husband, them not having their own identity other than the relationships that they have with men. Freaking sucks. And you totally see how, you know, she's like completely dependent on Ogi in terms of like income. And that is a struggle that a lot of Korean women used to have. Now there's a lot of Korean women in workplaces to a point where incels and the far right are trying to dismantle the Ministry of Gender Equality in Korea. And they're like, women are taking over our jobs. They should go to the military. It's a whole thing. But anyway.
Yeah. I mean, Ogi himself tries to justify it being like, oh, he talks about his tragic upbringing and how like he's overcome that by not thinking about it.
You see a bit of like his, like where he got his toxic masculinity from. And it's from his dad, who's like, oh, why are you studying? Why do you want to go to college? Be a man, like make your own money. And I was just like, okay, well, I feel like this is really weird because in Korea, education is like put on a pedestal and people right. judge you by what university you go to.
And wasn't it his wife that made him go to grad school in the first place and like is responsible for him being where he is now?
Yeah. And she, you know, and she was going to get her master's and, you know, it kind of sounded like she was supporting her husband and therefore like her like efforts into getting her master's like declined. And I'm like, wow, that's a common story. Like how many women have, you know, pushed the career aspirations of their husbands in, you know, at the cost of their own.
Yeah. And the interesting way that this is and I like that how in the book all of this is background information, right? Stuff that you pick up because, you know, the main narration is still told through the perspective of Ogi, and Ogi's world revolves around himself and what he needs and what he wants. And so I think it's definitely a book where you're constantly reading between the lines.
Yeah And you know, it's funny because like we talked about the visual cues in the novel, and the visual cue that neither Marvin and I experienced while reading this was at the corner of the page, there is a black hole. And it's like pretty small in the beginning of the book, but it gets larger and larger as you continue on into the chapters until it like completely swallows the page. And that kind of mirrors what we go through as readers when we're reading about Ogi, because everything is from his like one perspective of just like, oh my God, how tragic, he lost his wife and now he's disabled and paralyzed. Like, it's going to be a really hard recovery. But then we get more and more information and like our perspective expands as we continue reading the book.
And he kind of digs himself into a bigger and bigger hole, figuratively.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we start off being super sympathetic, and because here's a guy who just went through a terrible tragedy, lost his wife, is disfigured, lost control of his body, and is just in a very pitiful state. But the more we learn, the more we have to wonder, like, did he bring this on himself?
I mean, regardless, I don't think anyone deserves what he was put through by his mother-in-law. And let me just say, I think that is just a horror in itself, being completely dependent on your in-law. And you add that extra layer of, oh, I killed their only child. Or at least, you know, like, they died while I survived. It's like, oh, that's another layer of, I don't want to be completely dependent on you.
And then you add to the layer that there were marital problems that you eventually find out. And that the wife, and that, like we mentioned, he had a mistress. The wife probably found out because there were all these clues that she knew. And then you have to wonder, does the mom know? And
well, she does know, because she finds notes that her daughter had, like, left behind, because her daughter was, like, documenting all the things that were going bad in her marriage. And we don't get what she actually wrote in her notes, but we know that her mom found those notes, and she's like, wow, my daughter was really unhappy in this marriage.
Well, yeah, I mean, he's wondering that, right? And then he's also wondering, okay, so is all this stuff that she's putting me through, is this revenge? Is this actually one of those Korean revenge stories, right?
I mean, we do retribution pretty well in our storytelling. I mean,
we all know Koreans can hold a grudge.
Oh, yeah. We serve it hot. yeah, with his mother-in-law, you know, she's an interesting character, because when he is introduced to her, she's, like, completely guarded. Like, he has no idea what she's thinking. And he finds out that she's, you know, half Japanese, mixed race. And he's like, oh, that's why. And immediately writes her off as a foreigner. And anytime when she does something that he doesn't understand, he's like, oh, it's because she's Japanese. And I'm like, wow, what a Korean xenophobic way of thinking. And of course, that's, like, a messy...
It's a messy relationship, you know, like, to begin with.
Yeah, because, right? Like, Japan colonized Korea. So there's a lot of anti-colonial feelings. But you find out that his mother-in-law, she, like, went through a lot. She was separated from her birth mother when she was, like, in middle school because her father, who was Korean, decided to remarry to a Korean woman, and she got ripped away. And yeah, like, it would make sense that she would be so loyal to her only child, because really, like, that's her only family, because her husband is also garbage.
How much of that was, I mean, obviously it's toxic no matter how you look at it. It's a different type of toxic, where he's trying to, like, literally measure dicks with her daughter's new... Was he her husband then, or just they were together?
They were about to get married.
Yeah, and he's, like, trying to, like, prove his manhood against her daughter's new husband throughout this entire, like, dinner. And, yeah, like, he... I mean, on one hand, you can read that he's being protective of his daughter. On the other hand, he's kind of... Yeah, he was totally a jerk, too. And at this point, we know, even though Ogi does not admit it, he has an inferiority complex, right?
Yeah, 100%. And, you know, like, because he is an orphan, because his mother's death is presumed to be a suicide, there's a lot of stigma that is attached to his, I guess, like, family. And it makes sense, because in Korea, like, bloodlines are a very big thing. So, you know, when you're dating someone who doesn't have family, it's just like, oh, like, that's a little bit sketch. Like, we don't know, like, what kind of family that this person was raised in, what kind of genetic problem that they may have. And it's just like, it's so...
Right. It's the whole,
it's
like...
It's so toxic.
Well, if he's from a good family, why is he an orphan? Or if he's such a good guy, why is he an orphan? He must have done something to deserve it, right? Like,
yeah, and it's also still... just like, oh, how did your mom... Like, how did your dad die? Oh, was it, like, it was liver cancer? Well, what if your entire family has a history of liver cancer? And I'm like, so what? Almost every family has a history of cancer. That's how most people freaking die.
Yeah. Yeah, that was one of many uncomfortable exchanges in this book. I think the most uncomfortable one is actually the one where Ogie's mother-in-law invites his coworkers to the house.
Oh, yeah, that was really humiliating. Yeah, so like what happens in the book is she actually, you know, does hire a caretaker and a physical therapist after he is discharged from
Did you make of the fact that she, in between kind of being sinister, is also super caring and nurturing, right? Like kind of concerned about Ogie's recovery.
But that's only in the beginning, though. That's in the beginning before she kind of discovers the marital problems, because gradually she... You know, she gets rid of the caretaker. She says, oh, like, this physical therapist is too expensive. So he's going to not come, like, every day. He's going to come, like, once a week. And that's not how physical therapy works. And, like, as you go further into the book, she isolates him completely. No one visits him, not even his physical therapist. There's, like, no way for him to actually recover and get better. And he's just counting down the days until he can get his surgery. And even that gets taken away from him because his mother-in-law says, oh, isn't it ironic that, you know, your surgeon got into a car accident? Well, your surgery got pushed back like by 12 weeks. And you think that she's lying, but at the same time, it's like plausible enough.
I was more thinking, did she sabotage the surgeon's car?
Like, no, like, okay, so it could go both ways. It can actually have happened, and it just sounds, you know, it just sounds sinister coming from her. Or because you find out that there was a time when Ogie's wife, like when she was trying to get pregnant, for the IVF procedure, her original doctor got into an accident and she had to go with a different doctor. And she decided to pretty much like get the procedure done as scheduled, but with a different doctor. But that different doctor turned out to be a creep, pretty much. She felt very uncomfortable and violated. And she's like, I'm never going back. I'd rather not have a baby. So it's a situation that happened before, and he was like, oh, is this like revenge because that's kind of what happened to his wife? And it's just like a subtle jab of like, yeah, like I know everything that happened.
Yeah, I like that reading better. I like that reading of she is just like, I actually didn't realize that she must have found whatever his wife left behind in the process of his recovery. And that's why she suddenly turned into the evil mother-in-law. Or not evil, but the avenging mother-in-law, I guess.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, everybody in this book, their motives are questionable. They're not good people. But really, like, what defines a good person? Everybody has, like, their own skeletons in their closet. And can you really blame the mother-in-law for feeling vengeful? You can blame her for being a shitty caretaker.
Yeah, I mean, and being neglectful. You shouldn't abuse disabled people or someone who can't defend themselves. But at the same time, as a parent, you're allowed to feel resentment for having to take care of the guy who made your daughter's life miserable, I guess.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a very gray area. I'm not endorsing abuse of any kind.
This book is very, very gray. This book is very, very gray. Actually, it's like Ogie plants the seed in our minds as a reader. Like, oh, his wife tends to exaggerate and she'll remember events differently. And you're like, well, she's documenting all the things that, all the transgressions that happened in her marriage life, how much of it is real, how much of it is exaggerated.
Especially since we've seen that Ogie himself rationalizes everything away in like ways that benefit his point of view, right? His standing.
So we should probably talk about the treatment of the disabled in this book, because that is like where most of the horror lies.
Yeah. I mean, obviously Reaver and I are not physically disabled. So, and I don't think the author herself is neither, right?
No, she's not.
But I think imagining what it feels like to have a body that doesn't listen to you anymore is pretty horrific in itself. And I know it's some people's actual lived experience. And not to get ahead of ourselves, but next month's book club pick, we'll delve into one of those lived experiences. But you can really feel like the frustration of not being able to react to the things around you and people who take advantage of that.
Yeah. I mean, being paralyzed is, you know, it's a terrible experience, but I think a lot of the horror comes from other people, like how they treat you when you're disabled. Like his original caretaker, you know, she's, you know, treats him like a baby, because, you know, she changes his catheter and his bedpan, and you know, she like cracks jokes at his expense. She's like, "Oh, you're not talkative today." And it's like, okay, I guess you think you're so funny by like making jokes about his inability to speak. And he's like unable to like protect himself too. So that's like also really shitty. And then you have the fact that like he can write sloppily because, you know, his, I think it's his right hand. I don't remember which hand, but it still has some mobility. However, that means of communication is taken away from him. So really, the horror is unable to stand up for yourself, being seen as invisible or as a child, and being unable to express your thoughts. And those are things that could kind of easily be fixed by other people, but they're not giving him those opportunities.
I'm sure there's a metaphor there, right? It's probably like the things that he prided himself in, right? The things that he was able to overcome prejudices of being an orphan, or, you know, his ability to take care of himself, that all gets taken away. But somehow his toxic masculinity remains, right? Because he spends the entire book saying, "I'm still the best. I'm in the, like, look, I can move my leg 1 centimeter. I'm recovering. I'm going to go back to work and I'm going to be just as great as I used to be." And he spends literally the entire book with that mindset, which on one hand is a sign of his perseverance, but on the other hand is his inability to rely on other people.
It's also arrogance, 100%. I mean, he was arrogant before the accident and he's still arrogant. It's funny how you're mentioning how, you know, he thinks of himself as great because he overcame his like orphan background. But he does have an inferiority complex, like you mentioned. The house that he lives in with his wife, it's actually a townhouse with a yard. And when I read that, I was like, damn, like how much money did you spend? Like, Korea is, the land price is so expensive and everybody lives in apartments. So they're kind of seen as aspiring. And when he invites his colleagues for BBQs in his yard, it's a way of him showing off, being like, look at how well off I am. Oh, by the way, like this is how much I had to get a loan from the bank, but it's still humble bragging. And, you know, he also has tenure. He, like, just because he went into a field that's, like, not relatively well-known in Korea. And it's just like, oh, look, I made the smart decision of switching specializations. And now I have this treasured position, which he didn't even get fairly. So
I love that part of the humble brag is, check out how great my credit is. I can get such a huge loan that I have to pay off the rest of my life.
I mean, I'm sure people are wondering why the wife started gardening all of a sudden. It might seem like she was suddenly obsessed with it, because she does go through obsessions. And I just kind of laughed, because you find out that he had an affair with Jay. I already had my suspicions, but I was just like, oh, right. He totally had an affair with one of the colleagues. And then she was like, no more barbecues, and decided to just raise the entire yard for her gardening project.
Yeah, I mean, this was like the first of the major twists, right? And it comes about very subtly, right? Because for the first, I want to say probably a third of the book, you assume that he's torn up because he lost his wife. They had this great relationship. They had this great marriage. You know, she defended him against her father. And then there's that one scene where he has access to his phone and he calls someone. And you realize, I mean, that's your first clue that there's something else going on. Because it's not made explicit who he's calling, but obviously he's calling someone who he has a pretty deep relationship with. Like, what did you think about that scene where he picks up the phone and calls, like, his mistress, presumably?
I already knew that he was a toxic man and probably had a mistress. I kind of assumed that he had a mistress, especially, like, when there's a line in the book. Let me pull it out. It was, the 40s were ripe for sin, and there were two basic reasons. Either you had too much or you didn't have enough. In other words, the 40s were when you found it easy to do bad things out of power, out of anger, or out of feeling left behind. So I'm like, this is someone who, you know, thinks he is in the position of power, because he has like this position as a tenured professor. I'm like, yeah, why wouldn't he think that he deserves someone more successful, better? And you kind of see there's a line where, like, when they're having barbecue, that one of his colleagues got drunk and he, you know, helped them onto the couch. And you don't find out till later that that colleague is Jay. But like, when I read that scene, I was like, oh, it's totally a woman colleague, isn't it? And his wife totally saw him, like, being gentle with her. That was just kind of like my brain being like, it's like a toxic Korean man. Like, what are some toxic things that he can do? Being, like, cheating and... I was just like, it was just kind of there in front of my face. But for people who, I guess, weren't reading too much into it, because this book is a lot of, like, reading subtle hints.
Well, he also justifies it that, like, oh, we didn't do anything. But it's like, it's not that you didn't do anything, but, like, the emotional cheating was definitely there, right? His thoughts were definitely not pure at that point.
Yeah, and he also cheated twice, because he had a relationship with a student, and he begged for forgiveness, not to his wife, but to his mistress, being like, oh, it was like a one-time thing. They, like, one thing led to another. And I'm like, dude, you're like in your 40s and you're like coming on to a student. Like, it doesn't matter. That's gross.
Yeah. And I think, you know, this is also when the mother-in-law starts turning, right? She discovers that he made a call. And the horror in Ogi's mind when he realizes why she would just hit one number, right? One button to make a call. And it's like, oh, she must be redialing. And I wonder what she knows. And that's when the psychological battle of wits begins.
Yeah. Was that like before she called the colleagues over?
No, yeah, it was before.
Okay, so that's why she called, like, everyone over and kind of did this humiliating,
emasculated scene. Him in front of his colleagues, right? Because she literally changed his catheter in front of them, and you know, I'm sure we all know what catheters are, right? It's a thing you stick in the place where the pee comes out of. Yeah.
Yeah. So she's like changing his catheter. Like they see his, you know, penis. They see like the urine, and he's just, you know, it's like the humiliation of his mother-in-law, like doing that with his bare hands is like doing that with her bare hands is it's a lot. Especially she did it on purpose because she always wears gloves whenever she handles him. But like when she was in front of the company, she was like, I'm going to use my bare hands to make this as mortifying as possible. And you kind of realize that she knows more than she lets on because, you know, she's talking about widowhood. And she says, oh, you know what the best thing about being a widow? You can fuck whoever you want. And your dead spouse can never cheat on you anymore. And you're like, oh, okay.
I wonder what the Korean was for fuck.
I don't know. I don't know. This is why I wish I could read the Korean. I heard from an interview with Sora Kim Russell, the translator, that one of the things that she wished that she would be able to go back and kind of add more details is the ivy that grows all over his window.
Yeah.
So like the word in Korean that she uses, the word in Korean that's used to describe the ivy growing is tokada. And tokada can mean tenacious, which is kind of what she went for in the translation, but it could also mean poisonous. So I'm just like, huh, toxic masculinity literally represented in a plant, pretty much.
Yeah, this is making me sad that, like, you know, in translation, some of these double meanings are lost. And no, there's no shade to the translator. I'm sure she did the best she could. It's just some things that are hard to translate. But I did like that when the wife made this garden, like his one thing was no climbing vines. He's like, okay, but did it anyways.
Oh, but she did it in a sneaky way. She planted them at the back of the house. And she's like, oh, he's never going to see it because it's at the back of the house. But that's the room that he ends up in as someone who is paralyzed. And slowly, like, his view of the world, his only view of the outside world, gets covered out by this ivy. And I heard that Haeyong Pyeon's novels, it always features, like, nature being very...
petty.
I guess... not petty, but hostile to the men in her book. And I wonder if it's just like a commentary on like, you know how a lot of the times like nature is related to the mother or like the feminine energy. I'm
right.
Talking
and
like,
masculinity is all about taking control of nature, manipulating nature and like,
yeah,
making it bend to your will.
Yeah, and here is, you know, the one plant that did not die from his wife's hand that is, consuming him.
Yeah, I mean, you said in the beginning that this isn't a ghost story, but it's a ghost story. He's being haunted by the ghost of his wife.
I mean, it is terrifying also because, you know, he has nowhere else to go. So he's constantly, like, replaying memories and he's alone with his thoughts. And I'm like, wow, solitary confinement. That is a horror that anyone can imagine.
And you would think he would reflect on all the things he did wrong. And, like, I mean, he slowly gets to her, right? Like, the book ends on what I assume is an epiphany, that he's a piece of shit. But as the story goes on, he starts unraveling and, like, kind of breaking his facade of being, like, the most awesome husband. When he starts to think about all the ways that he let his wife down and all the things that they did, just couldn't communicate with each other. And which culminates in, I guess, reliving the night of the accident and what actually caused the car crash that killed his wife and left him disabled. And you realize that, and you know, he alludes to throughout the book that had they had made it to their destination safely, his mother-in-law might not even be his mother-in-law anymore, right? Like, this was a relationship that was at its terminal point.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, she wanted a divorce And he was like, I'm not going to give it to you. And, you know, she tried to, you know, blackmail him, being like, I know what you did to not get your position, but to secure your position, because you find out that he was a shitty human being who was like, I'm going to purposely slander my colleague, saying that he had an affair with a student. But that's like, but he justifies it by saying, oh, but it was like kind of true. He was coming on to students. So like, it's not like I didn't say anything that was untrue. Like he would have gotten like, you know, fired or demoted anyway. And it's like, but you did that,
bro, yeah,
for absolutely no reason. He literally says, sometimes another person's failure is insurance. And I was like, you did that for absolutely no reason. Not even for moral reasons of like, oh, he is a predator.
Yeah, and it makes you think, like, how much was he actually also gaslighting his wife, right? Like calling her a failure, like not supporting her dreams and her ambitions as well. And he ends up being that guy anyways, right? And, you know, we learned that the hotel they're heading towards is one of his love hotels.
Ugh. Gross. Yeah. But we find out that, you know, his wife kind of has this moment of impulse when he says, oh, I'm not going to give you a divorce. Like, what are you going to do? Like, you can't live by yourself. I'm the one who's bringing all the money. Like, I am the one who has the house. You have nothing. And she jumps on him and takes control of the steering wheel, and he pries her hands off, and that's when they rear end a truck, and then they tumble off the guardrail and off the hill. And, you know, it's like, I guess in his mind, he was like, oh, like, it's not my fault that she died. It was like, it was almost like she was trying to kill herself.
Which,
like, it's like, you missed the entire point, dude. But okay. So the title of the book is called The Hole. And the hole in this book is the hole that his mother-in-law is digging in the garden. And everyone mentions it, being like, yo, it's a really big hole in the garden. Like, what is she trying to plant? I mean, she says that it's going to be a koi pond, but is it really going to be a koi pond? And she, you know, she says, oh, it's like, I want to have something that is living in this house, because, you know, the garden was full of dead stuff. And I'm like, huh, are you, it's like, are you sure you want to see something living or to watch something dying in that hole?
I was still in horror mode. Is like, is she like murdering everyone that he's come in contact with and putting them in the hole? Like, is the doctor in there? Is Jay in there? Like, what's going on? Why is this hole so big?
I also like the part when like the physical therapist comes over, and, you know, like, he's like, Ogie at this point is in a really bad state because his mother has now like completely neglected him, like failing to feed him for a number of days, change him, and, you know, get rid of his bed sores and all of that. And the physical therapist is like, you need to take him to the hospital. What do you mean you have not taken him to the hospital? And you're just like, huh, okay. Like, she definitely is not taking him to the hospital until he's at a point where there is no recovery.
Yeah.
And it makes you think, like, oh, like, was she planning to keep him alive, but barely alive for the rest of his life? Or was she planning to kill him from the beginning by burying him in the
school? Yeah, maybe she was trying to keep him alive until she finished the hole. Because there was that one scene in the middle where they mention the surgery and how there's a chance he might be able to recover. And he notes that she has a look of terror on her face. Like, what do you mean he'll get better? And that was confusing for a while until you as the reader realize that she already knows.
I think it's interesting that, like, we keep saying, like, oh, he dug himself into a hole. And pretty much, like, at the end where he, has a little bit of mobility and he's like crawling out of the room and he goes into the garden. You know, his mother-in-law shows up and, you know, he notes that like she's not strong enough to drag him back to the room or do anything with him. So he tries to escape regardless, but she kind of like shuffles him towards the hole. But it's essentially his fault that he falls into this hole, though. So it's just like, oh, okay. Like, it's kind of funny that he was afraid of this hole that he fell into himself. A situation that could have been avoided if he wasn't also a bad husband. And
this is following his, you know, the physical therapist comes and he's so excited to show him, look, I can move my leg like a centimeter to the left. And then the physical therapist just says, oh, no, bro, that's nothing. that's just being paralyzed, man. And I wonder if this is when his like breakdown begins, when he realizes that he really is in the hopeless place. Because the very next chapter is the one where he drags himself out of bed and into the hole. And once he's in that hole is when he finally has this epiphany that maybe he is a piece of shit.
I mean, like, this book talks about, like, emptiness and isolation. And when he's in that hole, he's like, oh, maybe, like, all the, you know, emptiness that my wife felt in her life is because of me.
Yeah, and maybe the ending I'm of the baddie.
At the ending of the book, he kind of has a memory of his wife reading a story about a man who almost has like an almost death experience, a near death experience. A steel beam like falls down like millimeters away from him. And he realizes, oh, wow, I could have died, and decides to just leave his life behind. Like, doesn't bring any belongings, doesn't tell his family. He just leaves. And his wife, who, you know, is just like, what happened to my husband? Oh, my God, like foul play, blah, 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 blah. She hires a detective and she finds out that he just moved to another city and just started over again. And Ogi's wife is very emotional about this. And Ogi's like, what's wrong? It sounds like, I mean, he's so lucky. He was able to survive and... You know, he's like living his life. Like, why? Like, are you upset because, you think that I'm going to leave you? I'm never going to leave you. And she starts crying. And to me as a reader, I'm like, she's not crying because she's afraid that you're going to leave her. In fact, she wants you to leave her so that she can restart her life because she feels like everything that she does is a failure because he constantly tells her that, you know, she's unable to amount to anything. So I was like, okay, well, he finally got it at the end when he's in the hole.
Was he said something like, if you die, I'll die with you or something like that?
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah. And that's how the story comes to a close. What do you think, Rira? Does the mother-in-law fill in that hole with Oki in it?
I mean, at this point, yeah, because, like, he's not going to be able to crawl out of it. I think a sick thing that she might do is that she just leaves him there and she doesn't, like, bury him. And then, you know, she, like, goes to the authorities and being like, oh, my God, I, like, left the house for, like an hour and all of a sudden he's here and he fell and it was an accident. Oh, no.
The perfect crime.
The perfect crime. But we did have some comments in our discussion thread. Nina said, this is one of those books that I'm very glad will be discussed on the podcast. Very dark and hard for me to process what each character's motivations are and their deep lack of empathy.
Well, I hope we helped with that. I don't know. I'm not sure.
I don't know if the mother-in-law, I mean, the mother-in-law definitely was not empathetic to Ogi and his...
Well, she was, you know, at first, disabled. And then she became vengeful, and obviously it's presumably because she discovered his shittiness, like discovered that he was a shitty husband to her daughter and needed him to suffer for it.
Yeah, I mean, she's not a good person.
Oh, yeah. I mean, obviously the lesson taken from this book should not be you should abuse disabled people if they're bad people. I mean, no one deserves to be.
No one deserves that kind of abuse. Actually, around the time when this book got published, I heard that there was a protest for more accessibility for disabled people in Korean subways. And one of the things that they did was they would put a wheelchair in the middle of the tracks and, you know, the train would have to stop. Mm. And it's like, and it was pretty much them saying, oh, you can't take the train? Well, we can't take the train either because you guys refuse to see us as, you know, also human beings who should be able to have accessibility to public transportation as well.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, it could be a commentary on how shitty society is to disabled people in Korea. But, you know, this is a problem that America has as well. I think it's even more of a bigger problem in America than it is in Korea in terms of accessibility.
I mean, it could be both, right?
Because healthcare.
It could be both, right? You know, because you have the example of the mother-in-law who's obviously doing it for revenge. But you also have the son of the caretaker who just abuses Ogi because he's there and he can't do anything about it. So you do have examples of like the callousness of how some people don't see disabled people as human or fully.
Yeah. And even when his colleagues show up, like, you know, they have conversations without him because they're like, well, he can't talk back. So what's the point? So they pretend that he like doesn't exist.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunately a struggle that a lot of disabled people go through. Another comment that we got is from Catherine. Great pick for October. The imagery of the vines climbing and covering the window was very creepy to me. Yes, same thing for me. The story reminded me a bit of The Vegetarian, the similarities between the wife characters and how the story is built around a character we get third-person view of. What Ogi is put through is obviously terrible, and the humiliation scenes were unsettling to read. He sucks, parentheses, not justifying what happened to him, close parentheses, but I could understand, parentheses, to a point, close parentheses, how a mother-in-law in her grief wanted some type of revenge. Yes, I agree with almost all of your points. I have read The Vegetarian by Han Kang, and there is definitely a similarity in the wife characters. You know, they are treated very poorly by the patriarchy, and they do want to be able to have a space of their own, and it kind of manifests through plants. It's really interesting because The Vegetarian is written by a different author.
I love how everyone is of the same mind that like Ogi sucks. He doesn't deserve what happened to him, but he definitely sucks, and you can't really, you know, you can't fault the mother-in-law for feeling the way she does. And it really is just, you know, it's motive, means. This whole book essentially is the prequel to A Murder Mystery, right? The sequel to The Hole will be when the quirky detective comes to solve the unearthing of a body in this backyard.
We can only imagine. but essentially, this book is about people with power and people without power, and the people with power will always use it to corrupt themselves.
Yeah.
I mean, we see it with Ogi, how he, you know, uses his position to advance his own ambitions. And we see it with his mother-in-law, who is using her power to keep him disabled and to steal his autonomy, pretty much, or whatever is left of it.
Yeah.
But that was our discussion of The Hole.
Yeah, a great pick.
I'm sorry if we didn't like explain a lot of the things that happened in the book. Like I said, I read this through Audible, through an audiobook.
I think we did a pretty good job. I think we were pretty thorough. I mean, I think we did a pretty good job describing the themes. I think, we did great. We're like Ogi. We're awesome. We're so good discussing books.
Like, listen, I said this before, like, there are a lot of subtle details that you could totally miss. And a lot of this book is like reading between the lines. Since I read this through audiobook, I missed a lot of those details. So I had to resort to looking at interviews and analysis and, you know, like comparing notes and stuff, seeing what I got right, what I got wrong. So I too struggled.
Which, to be fair, is how you should consume media, right? Read the book, have your own takes, compare it to what other people say, you know, develop those thoughts and bring it to this podcast. Yeah, good job, us. I think we did great. And that's not being toxic, I hope. All right. Well, now that we're in the month of November, what are we reading for book club?
Like we mentioned earlier, we are reading The Year of the Tiger, An Activist's Life by Alice Wong. Alice Wong is the founder of Disability Visibility, and this is kind of a memoir, but mostly a collection of essays. It's about her journey in becoming an activist and what it means to be disabled and also a person of color. So a lot of the art that is in the book, they are commissioned art by disabled and Asian American artists. Yeah, it's kind of a nice surprise that we're reading this like right after the whole.
Yeah, it's almost
as if that to happen. What? Let me just say that was a coincidence. That was not.
Let's just not call what it serendipity, synchronicity. Let's call it just a fortunate occurrence.
Well, but this is our first nonfiction in a very long time. I think the last nonfiction we read was A Good Talk by Mira Jacob. And that was a graphic memoir. So, yeah, we can always use more diversity in our reading.
All right, we'll be discussing that book at the end of November. So you have until then to get your thoughts in into your Goodreads forums. As always, we love to include the thoughts of our members in our discussion whenever available. And yeah, that'll do it for this episode of Books and Boba and our discussion of The Hole by Hae Young Kyung. Thank you all for joining us again, and we hope to see you all next time. Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to Books and Boba. This podcast was hosted by Marvin Yue and Rira Yu and edited and produced by Marvin Yue. Follow the book club on Twitter and Instagram by going to @booksandboba and engage with us on Goodreads on our Goodreads group. You can also check out past episodes of the podcast by going to booksandboba.com and by subscribing to us on your favorite podcast app. Don't forget, you can support Books and Boba and Asian American authors by purchasing books at our bookshop.org account. Check out the link in our show notes and also at booksandboba.com. Books and Boba is a proud member of the Potluck Podcast Collective, a collective of Asian American hosted podcasts featuring unique voices and stories from the Asian diaspora. Learn more about the collective and check out our fellow Potluck shows by visiting the website podcastpotluck.com. Thanks for listening.
Hey, I'm Phil Yu, and you may know me from a blog called Angry Asian Man.
And I'm Jeff Yang, author, journalist, and celebrity dad.
We host a podcast called They Call Us Bruce, an unfiltered conversation about what's happening in Asian America.
Each week or so, we host a discussion about some of the most vital and interesting topics in our pop culture and our community, bringing in guests who are shaping and informing this thing called Asian America from Hollywood to D.C. and beyond.
We've got media, entertainment, food, family, politics, representation.
The good, the bad, the WTF of it all.
So check us out wherever you get your podcasts or at theycallsbruce.com.
Peace.
Peace.